Welcome to the Baxter Building.
We make a point to do family dinner every week. Sunday at 7, on the dot, no matter what. We're all here.
Kirby, how's that sauce coming?
Yeah, I'll be the judge of that.
Okay. Okay, is this guy good or what?
I want to add a couple cloves of garlic. Not because it's not delicious, I just want to add a little bit of zip, okay?
T-5.
Before we went up the first time, you couldn't turn invisible. Ben wasn't a rock.
The best pilot in the world right here.
Yeah, best looking, he means.
And Johnny never caught fire.
Ben has always been a rock. Johnny is Johnny.
Hi.
And I am right here. Whatever life throws at us, we'll face it together. As a family.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Third Degree Burn. I'm your guest host, Kirk Greenfield, and we have a very special presentation for you. Out of sequence, this is a standalone show that I think you're really going to enjoy. We have three guests with us, three other hosts, I should say. First, we have Brian Hughes.
Hey!
And Tim Elliott.
Hello.
And we have Nigel Sphinx from Japan. Hello!
Hello there.
Well, now that I've whetted your appetite, I'm going to let Brian introduce the details of what he has to present today. Brian?
Yeah, what we're covering today is an incredibly special issue of the Fantastic Four. It was put out for the 20th anniversary of the Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four is how old now? 60-something? It's 63 years old now, the Fantastic Four. So this issue came out in 1982, and that's issue 236, a very special issue, Terror in a Tiny Town, of course, done by John Byrne. And it's got a lot of special things going on in it, a lot of really cool things going on in it, and, you know, a couple things that we probably want to discuss because they're more than likely the elephant in the room.
Now, this is a double-sized issue, right? It's larger than most, right?
Yeah, the story itself was 40 pages.
It says triple-sized on the cover.
Yeah, that's because they had the backup story in there, which we'll talk about that, too. Not at length like we would about Terror in a Tiny Town, but the challenge of Dr. Doom as the backup story has got a very interesting little history to it.
Well, I remember this issue, in particular, the cover, which is not your typical cover because it's more or less a collage of all the different characters, all kind of, as I recall, all kind of gathered around the Fantastic Four. And how many characters would you say are on it? It's basically a white cover, but how many figures would you guesstimate are on the cover?
I'd say about 40.
Okay. Yeah. And there's some controversy over who's not on the cover.
41.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about that little elephant in the room, okay? What happened was when they started working on this, Jim Shooter had gone to Byrne and said, hey, for the 20th anniversary, we want this to be very special. Like, if you were to make a movie of the Fantastic Four, that's how we want it to be. And so that's what Byrne kind of put together in this, and I think he succeeded quite well. When he was doing the cover and he did all this, he drew it with Kirby, with Lee and Kirby on it. Now, most people think it was right beside Lee, but it's actually in front of Lee since Kirby was a bit shorter than Stan Lee. So he would have been in the part that would have been in that circle that you see on there that says special triple-sized issue. Now, when Byrne did this, the art, he sent in the penciled artwork, and he put a note on there for Maurice Severin to clean up the images of Stan and Jack, make them look better. So that's actually Marie Severn art on Stan that's been inked by Terry Austin. And then, of course, Jim Shooter comes along and says, no, remove Kirby from the art altogether. And it wasn't stated it was because of legal issues or anything else going on. It's just that's the edict from Shooter. Byrne was not even aware of this until he actually saw the printed issue. So by the time he found out, there was nothing he could say or do. What do you guys think?
Incredibly petty. Very sad that it had to come to that. But the fact is, he lives on, his reputation lives on, whether or not he was on the cover. We know he was there in spirit. So, you know, it is.
Yeah, well, let's say that he was in court fighting for the, you know, basically creator's rights and, you know, basically the money that he thought that he should have gotten as part of that. And that Shooter probably had, you know, that, you know, taken off to, you know, not sit there and say, yeah, he's one of the creators along with Stan. And if they did, if that got into lawsuit and went into court and they had put Jack on the cover there while this was going on, I could see a court seeing, you know, seeing it Jack's way. Not saying they shouldn't. I think they should.
Well, the interesting, the wiki says that it was removed on Kirby's request.
And I've heard that elsewhere before. Of course, I'm going based on what Byrne has you know, said and what he's put on his website. So, I mean, I don't know who said it was Kirby, because he wouldn't have told any of the publications himself. He asked them to remove him. I'd not seen that anywhere. And that particular line has gone around an awful lot. But like I said, I'm going by what Byrne had said himself. And has been reported in other magazines and other websites. And I've gone around, looked at a lot of places. The main line seems to be that Shooter is the one that ordered it.
Well, here's the thing. Kirk, whether you think that it was petty that Shooter did it, if Marvel does not want to pay Kirby the rights or whatever the situation was, then they are not going to put him on there if that will interfere with any kind of, like you said, lawsuit going on.
Right.
It's not so much petty. It's just like they're protecting themselves. They don't want to pay him. They're not going to give him any more ammunition to allow him to win his lawsuit or whatever that is. I mean, so it could have been vindictive. I don't know. It could have been, you know, you hear when it comes to Shooter, there's always two sides to it. You hear one side that's very negative, and then you'll hear other sides that are not so negative. So.
Well, there's always three sides where Shooter's concerned. There's the bright positive side where he's the hero of the day. There's the negative side where everybody talks about how he was pretty crappy about it. And then there's the truth in there in the middle.
Somewhere. And that's probably the truth of anything going on. But Marvel has got a track record, especially once the movies started coming out, of not really paying some of these creators, whether we think they deserve it or not. I mean, if you sign a contract that says you get A and then something becomes super popular and then you want more money, yes, could the company write, you know, should they on a moral basis give you more? Or are they honoring the contract that you signed and they're giving you exactly what you got? So it's a gray area.
Remember the guy that started Victoria's Secret? I mean, he just wanted a nice shop that he could go to buy lingerie for his wife, a market opportunity. And he then sold the shop to, I think, the Limited or whoever it was that bought it for about $4 million. And then they turned it into a billion-dollar enterprise.
Yeah.
Now, that guy made millions. He made enough to live the rest of his life without ever having to work. But he still jumped off a bridge after that happened.
Well, you never know. I mean, could he have made it that successful on his own? Possibly not. So
probably not. Probably not. Crazy, crazy stuff. And then there's also the discussion about the backup story in this, the challenge of Dr. Doom. Now, I don't know how many people read this. If you actually look at the story in back there, what you'll notice is it's not drawn like any other Kirby story. It looks more like a newspaper strip that's been put together into a comic book. And that's because that story is actually made from the storyboards from the Fantastic Four cartoon. And it's a retelling, I believe, of Fantastic Four number 5, which was the first appearance of Dr. Doom, where Ben Grimm does the whole Blackbeard thing, except instead of having Johnny in it, they've got Herbie the Robot. And they just took the storyboards from that cartoon that Jack Kirby had drawn, and they inked them, colored them, lettered them, and placed them in the book in this story way. Now, why they did it, you know, in some way it was a nod to Jack, I'm sure. But, I mean, he himself was like, what are they doing? Why are they doing this? And he actually gave some blame to Byrne, saying some friends of Byrne's were involved in getting this done. But just kind of weird. I mean, I myself couldn't really read the story. I didn't like the way it was laid out there. But that's just me.
Blame or credit? I mean, you know, if they were friends of Byrne and Byrne was trying to give him credit, you know, I don't know that blame is the right word.
Well, even Byrne said that he was pleased to be mentioned by Jack, that Jack knew his name, but he just didn't understand the context.
Right. So, well, it's also very popular that at this time the media and the press was so so underdeveloped. Well, I'll say, you know, you had Comic Buyer's Guide newspaper that everybody was reading at the time. It was the best organ for information in the industry, and everybody was jockeying for position, trying to get their project positioned in that newspaper. I think this is before Comic Shop News, a little flyer that was passed around or passed out at comic shops.
But certainly before Wizard.
Probably before Wizard.
Around back then, I don't think so, but at any rate, we didn't have as many outlets. The internet didn't exist. So, you know, everybody wanted to have a story or wanted to get a story in print about what they had turned up about a creator or the latest projects or what have you. So you had a lot of different voices that were trying to get, I won't say the most scandalous story, but the most interesting story out there, because the average fan didn't know any of the background, didn't know any of the creators, although the rise of the creator-created comic book, I'm not saying this very clearly, the rise of the auteur or the recognition for the creators was on the rise in the 80s. But prior to that, I'd say the vast majority of fans just wanted a 12 or 15-cent comic book off the stands. And they didn't know anything about the background unless Stan had told them that, oh, yeah, we're switching artists from here to there, or in the bull page bulletins, you know, that they got only what the company was telling them, instead of having fans and independent voices being heard in I'll say the marketplace, but I mean in print. So you kind of have to understand at the time, people were rushing to pitch the most controversial story or the scandalous story to try to get it and get a reputation out there, not only for themselves, but also in terms of adding more fodder to this growing body of knowledge of that creators were people and that they had emotions and conflicts and, you know, behind the scenes. Prior to this period, we really didn't know much about the creators at all, unless Stan told us about them.
Well, and you never hardly ever knew what they looked like. You know, you didn't see a lot of pictures.
The only thing that we would have seen would have been perhaps in the back of an annual, a king-sized annual, where there were a two-page spread of individual headshots of all the Marvel bullpen, and they didn't look anything like you imagined they would. That was the only outlet, the only way that you would know what they looked like, unless they drew themselves into the story, as Stan and Jack did back in FF number 10. But even that was sort of cartoonish.
Or if you ran across them at a con and happened to see him at a table.
That's true. And I did not have that experience, so I can't speak to that. I was in the Midwest. I think in New York and possibly L.A. and major cities, yeah, I think the rise of fandom, you did line up at the tables for signatures and to speak to them. That was on the rise.
You know, it's funny, though, because in the 80s, there were two guys in the business that were pushing for creator rights more than anyone. Do you know who those two guys were?
One was Shooter.
Jim Shooter was one, and Neil Adams was the other.
Yeah.
Because Neil Adams was spearheading the campaign for Siegel and Shuster to get a better piece of the pie for their creation of Superman that they basically sold for $160 way back in the day.
Right.
Boy. Anyway, with all that being said, though, you know, that's just the window dressing around what is really one of the great comic book stories of the day, Terror in a Tiny Town, because it gives you the origin of the Fantastic Four without giving you the origin of the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. It gives you the main crux of what the characters are like. And it, you know, shows you the importance of the rivalries that they have, not just with Dr. Doom, but the Puppet Master. But I guess what we should do, or what I should do, is go ahead and give you guys the specifics. Now, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, good. Our story, of course, is Terror in a Tiny Town from Fantastic Four, number 236. Cover date of 1981, on sale date August 18, 1981. Cover price a whopping $1 for back then. What was the regular price on the books? Was it 50 cents at this point? 1981, 82?
60 maybe.
60. And okay, the page count on this one, of course, is 64 pages. It, of course, was written, the story, Terror in Tiny Town, which is a 40-page story, was written by John Byrne, penciled and inked by the same guy, John Byrne, colored by Glynis Wien, and lettered by James R. Novak. Editor on the book was James Salicrup, or Sneaky Salicrup, as he called himself in his X-Men days. And this thing has been reprinted so many times, most notably the Fantastic Four Visionaries trade paperback, which is a really, really good transfer of that. I've got a digital copy myself, and it's gorgeous. Then, of course, there's the Marvel Masterworks. I don't know if the quality on that one is as good. This is volume 21. And that just came out, 5 years ago. And then, of course, the Fantastic Four, John Byrne Omnibus, volume 1. That one's recolored, so they fixed some of the color issues that happened in the original. And then there's a Dr. Doom, the Book of Doom Omnibus that came out in 2022. And I haven't looked at that one, though. All right. Let's see what else we got here. In November of 81, we had a blockbuster. Hold on a second. I got to stretch this thing out. Blockbuster number 6. This is a British anthology book that reprinted stories from Iron Fist number 3. And then there's Marvel Superheroes number 379 and other British anthology books, which reprinted stories from Avengers 184. So really, this is all Byrne was actually working on at this point in time. He was between other jobs. I think, wasn't this around the time he did the Batman, Untold Legends of the Batman?
No, because this is 81. Yeah. 81,
yeah, that was earlier than that. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, one other thing I found was kind of interesting was, you know, that nice big two-page spread where you see Doom standing over them, finally revealing himself? That was actually inspired by the cover to Fantastic Four 84, The Name is Doom. And looking at that, I can see what he was going for. So that's pretty cool. All right, now, here comes the synopsis, and I want you all to sit back and relax. This is a long one. I wrote it out myself, reading the story. I felt it deserved that kind of treatment. Even though there were synopses out there, I just wanted to make sure I covered it myself and got it right. Here we go. Nighttime at the missile base. Four specially suited travelers sneak past the base guards and board a special rocket. They launch into the sky with no control tower. No help on the ground should something go wrong. They launch into history. They break out the bonds of Earth's gravity and into the massive rays of cosmic energy. The ship should take the brave foursome back down to Earth to discover that they have become so much more than they have. Something fantastic. But it doesn't. Not this time. This time the rocket crashes into the Earth, waking Johnny Storm with a jolt. Johnny gets up from his dream and starts his day, having slept through his alarm. He showers, changes, and hops into his hot rod to drive off, not to New York, not to the Baxter Building, but to the humble residence of Reed and Sue Richards in the town of Littleville. A forgetful Reed tries to head off to work without his briefcase. Sue catches him just in time and gives him the case as he walks off. Sue and Johnny talk about Reed's troubles with befuddlement and how a superior at work, Professor Vaughn, treats Reed as an incompetent. Sue then mentions that she's having dreams that sound similar to Johnny's, though he doesn't say anything to that fact. Johnny heads off thinking about the very dull life in the town of Littleville and contemplates moving to New York when he passes Ben Grimm's tavern and restaurant. Standing out in front of the tavern is a very human Ben Grimm. And after the two exchange greetings, Johnny continues his drive through town as Alicia Masters. Now, Alicia Grimm comes up behind Ben, asking if that was Johnny she just saw. As Ben confirms Alicia's query, she mentions that she expected him to talk to Johnny about the dreams he's been having of late. He brushes the questions off just to say how happy he is to hear her even talking about seeing anything, that her mentioning it makes him feel good all over. He then tells Alicia, "I love you, Miss Grimm," and she replies in kind. Across the street from the Grimm's kiss, we now see Philip Masters in front of his toy shop watching his stepdaughter and son-in-law's embrace. All is going exactly as he wanted, and he's very happy about it. That night, Sue has another of the odd dreams that she, Ben, and Johnny have all been experiencing. This time, it's before the launch, a conversation where Sue calls Ben a coward as Ben resists going on to the mission. Ben heads towards Susan, his clothes ripping as he transforms into an orange, rocky form. In this form, he grabs a suddenly stretching part of Reed as Johnny smashes a chair on him. Ben throws burning embers from the fireplace onto Johnny, who erupts into a flaming form. Sue screams out loud, waking herself and Reed from their slumber. She tells him of her dream and how parts of it felt so real, then sets off as she hears Franklin, who's crying, who heard, she woke up. Reed considers Sue's dream, but not much as he considers his own inadequacies. The next day, though, Reed and Johnny share lunch at Ben's tavern and talk about Sue's dream. Johnny admits he's having similar dreams. Ben overhears Reed and Johnny talking as he brings over their breakfast for lunch, sausage, eggs, and hash browns. Ben tells Reed and Johnny that he too has been having the same type of dreams as Johnny and Susan. As the three compare notes, Alicia and her stepfather show up and join them for lunch. Conversation goes far away from the fantastic. Later, as Reed returns to work, his colleague, his one friend, Singh, shows Reed some new technology the school's acquired, a particle accelerator. Reed considers aloud the applications for such a device, but is interrupted and shut down by his boss, Professor Vaughn, who denies him access to such a machine and ushers him off to teach his class while belittling Reed all along. As Reed walks off, Vaughn mentally gloats to himself, "This plan is working perfectly." Later, after class, Reed sits in his classroom alone, contemplating the dreams the others are experiencing. He laments lacking the ability to concentrate as he unintentionally drifts off to sleep. And now, Reed dreams, not just about the origin of the Fantastic Four like the others. No, he dreams about their life, their day-to-day activity of the Fantastic Four. He even dreams about how Philip Masters, Alicia's stepfather, as a villainous puppet master, put the four and family under his sway and makes them travel to Doom's Castle in the Adirondack Mountains. I always say that wrong. At this point, Reed is suddenly awoken and his chair spills over and causes Reed to hit his head hard. As he gets up, head ringing in pain, he realizes that his head is also clear, that he's no longer befuddled. He knows that his dream was real and that they are the Fantastic Four. But how can they truly be without their powers? He goes to the biology lab and gets a scalpel. In order to prove his body is robotic, he plunges the blade deep into his arm. The pain and loss of blood are too much for him. He collapses to the floor as a pool of red liquid collects under his arm. An hour later, a ragged Reed comes home where everyone, including Ben, Alicia, and Johnny, are there waiting for him as he is late and Sue is worried. Reed's sleeve looks blood-soaked. Reed now tells the rest about what he's discovered, about who they really are, and how they're somehow trapped in artificial bodies. At first, they don't believe him. Soon enough, though, Philip Masters finds himself being attacked by Ben, who forces the Puppet Master to come clean. None of their current life is real. The town is a sham, and the others, people, are robots. That's all of the FF and family are Synthaclones, puppets. Masters admits he did it for Alicia so she could be happy with Ben. Reed interrupts as he knows Masters doesn't have the technology to implement such a plan. It is then that Dr. Doom reveals himself, not in Littleville, but from the sky above. Doom towers over Littleville as a massive giant, gloating about how only he could have taken Philip Masters' plot and turned it into Doom's perfect vengeance against his most hated enemies. Part 2, If This Be Doomsday. Doom stands next to his trap, a miniature town with the FF wired in, including Franklin and Alicia. All of them lay on devices spread around the miniature town that have them all jacked into the system, maintaining Littleville. Doom gloats over Reed and the rest, assuring that they are forever trapped and no longer worthy of his attention. He turns his back on them as he is now intent on getting his throne and Latveria back. As the Fantastic Four regroup, they pry the Puppet Master for any information that may help, but find that he is as trapped as they are. And then Masters takes off out the door in an effort to find a way to get his own revenge on Doom. Instead of chasing after Masters, though, Reed tells the rest that they must work towards getting their powers back if they're going to be able to confront Doom again. Reed gets started, secluding himself away from the others. Ben and Alicia decide to go back to their home so they can talk. Sue tries to check in on Reed, but he is driven, abrupt, and cannot be bothered. The next morning, Alicia comes over to the Richards home to tell Sue that Ben has run off, angry that his happiness was all a lie. The whole family goes out looking for Ben, but it is Reed that recalls that Ben likes to go to hilltops for meditation. Ben tells Reed that he just doesn't want to go back. He just stands to lose so much with Alicia if he becomes a thing again. He says they should let someone else handle Doom. Reed tries to convince him, but Ben is resolute. Reed says goodbye. Sue, Johnny, Alicia, and Franklin all join Reed as he returns to the Littleville College. Reed needs the keys to the physics lab, and only Doom's robot in the town, Victor Vaughn, had a copy. They step into Vaughn's office to find that Vaughn's robot is there, but the office is empty except for a chair. Reed is able to fetch the key from the robot suit pocket. The group then go to the physics lab and find the particle accelerator is there, truly functional. Doom could not take the chance that Reed would spot a fake, even in his befuddled state. Reed sets the device to make their synthaclone forms 20 times more powerful. Otherwise, their powers will be ineffectual. Reed, Sue, and Johnny all begin to argue about who should go under the radiation stream first, but are all shouted down by Ben, who just entered. Ben has returned just in time and jumps into the accelerator's platform, telling Reed to start it up, pushing to start as quick as possible so he can't change his mind. Reed bombards Ben with the cosmic rays, and Ben transforms once again to the ever-loving blue-eyed thing. Alicia comes into the room, and Ben begs her to leave, but Alicia tells him that she has known what Ben looks like as a thing all along, and that she doesn't love him because of her blindness, but despite it. Later, Johnny is strolling a road just out on the outskirts of Littleville when he's approached by several of Doom's guardian robots who appear to be made down to the size of the Littleville population. Johnny flames on and slags the robot closest to him. Long, outstretched arms wrap around another of the robots, and an unsubtle, unstoppable thing upturns the Earth underneath several more of Doom's robots while yelling out his patented war cry, "It's clobbering time." Pancakes three robots to the tune of Rice Krispies under a piece of Earth he's pulled up. The rest of the four join to rout Doom's robot guards, including Susie, using her force powers to test the new strength Reed provided. She and Ben make short work of the robots, Sue trapping them into a conduit, and Ben crushing it flat. Johnny starts to fly upwards towards a wall that would take him outside of the Littleville environment. Reed tells Johnny to stop, fearing Doom may have set heat sensors along the top. It's now Sue that comes to the rescue, creating a flat force field beneath the team to carry them outside the environment. Reed warns the team not to get too used to the expanded powers. Even with her heightened powers, getting the team out of Littleville and onto the floor of the control room taxed Sue a good bit, so much so that Reed had to reach up onto the control panel himself. But with his heightened abilities, reaching up there was no difficulty. The rest of the team follows Reed. Looking around, Reed works to locate the primary power shuttle module, but Doom has removed it from the console. Reed contemplates Doom's habits and gets the team working, using Doom's system's redundancies to the team's benefit. They work 10 hours straight. Reed provides specific, almost cryptic orders to the rest. Finally, Reed has Johnny blast the recycling system for the Littleville River. Johnny does so, and the Littleville water source begins to pour outside of Littleville and onto the floor of Doom's control room. Reed had hoped this would set off an alarm, but it doesn't. Sue decides that she must go and lure Doom back to them. Though Reed protests, Sue's argument wins over, and she takes off, flying on her force field. She flies through the castle for nearly half an hour before she hears some strange, haunting music. She follows the sound and finally arrives to a candlelit room where Doom plays at a grand piano. Sue maneuvers herself to get a better view of Doom, who's sitting there, unmasked. Even in her diminutive side, her barely audible gasp is enough to alert Doom to her presence. He rises and she attacks him, noting he doesn't have his gloves on so he can't hurl energy bolts at her. She hurls many, many tiny force balls at him, but Doom quickly grabs a close-by goblet and traps her under it. Doom, realizing that Fantastic Four have gotten their powers back, hurries down to the control room to see it flooded, along with the electrical wiring strewn about. Seeing this for a clumsy trap, Doom blasts with his gauntlet, just as Reed hoped. The blast feeds back into the generator per Reed's machinations. Then Reed sends Johnny on his next task, attacking Doom himself. Johnny blasts Doom's head and hood, hoping to distract him. It works, too. Doom blasts wildly with his gauntlets all around, unable to hit Johnny, who's flying loops around the dictator, leading him into position. Once he was there, Reed stretched himself around Doom's legs. And as the tiny thing hit Doom's foot to throw him off balance, Doom begins to fall right under Reed's trap. A massive blast erupts. And then the Fantastic Four awake in their true bodies. Reed tells them all to be in full alert. Alicia calls out to Ben that she is blind again. As Ben comforts her, Reed keeps his attention on whatever attack Doom may unleash on them. But there is none. Instead, Johnny finds an immobile Dr. Doom laying on the floor in a catatonic state. Reed surmises the power surge he triggered went through Doom's armor and tripped some sort of defense mechanism to put Doom in stasis. Accepting the victory, but being cautious, Reed has Ben take Doom's body so they can ensure Doom can't endanger them further. They can't locate the puppet master, though he must have been accessing Littleville remotely, so his body was not there. Making Doom their top priority, the Fantastic Four leave, taking Doom's body with them. Doom watches them leave, his mind now in the tiny body down in Littleville environment. He plans to wait for the right moment, then uses transference ring to put his mind back in his true body. However, as he looks over the ring as his instrument of escape, it and his hand are struck hard by a rock thrown at him, breaking the ring. Doom now sees that the Puppet Master is still there and is taking control of the townspeople. The townspeople are gathered en masse with pitchforks, rocks, bats, sticks, and hammers. The Puppet Master chides Doom for twisting his dream of happiness for Alicia. Masters then orders the townspeople to destroy Doom. Doom runs, knowing that if his body dies here, he will die out there. but also knowing that his robot body will not tire. But then again, neither will they. Neither will they. The end.
Nicely done.
That was a long one. That was a great story, though.
You know, that's the first time that I've understood the story. I don't know how many times I read it when it came out, but it kind of escaped me. It just was, there were too many different levels that I didn't understand at the time.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, Kirk, because there were things in this story that made me think of the movie Inception.
Yes.
Even down to Reed falling in his chair and hitting his head, kind of like the kick that they would give them in the movie Inception. But go ahead.
Well, no, I don't have anything else to share. It's just I had always heard this was a great story. I bought it as it was coming out, having just started with, you know, 232 and 233. And, you know, we're only like 4 months into Byrne's run. So we were gathering steam and really enjoyed it. But I couldn't quite wrap my head around this story, where it fit in. And so it was sort of a one-off for me that I've just kind of always compartmentalized off to the side and never really thought that much about.
Well, it's very, really talked about very Twilight. It's very Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Yes. I did find one inconsistency in the story, though. Just one thing that it wouldn't change anything in it. It's just an artistic choice that Byrne made, was that when they tripped Doom into the Reed's trap, Doom falls there and then winds up catatonic on the floor, but the floor should be covered completely in water and is bone dry when they go find him.
Maybe the water
drained away
really quick, or yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. It just looked like it was very deep when Doom went in there. And all that took the place in a matter of seconds, really.
Anyway. I think Reed says it should be, the river would flood the floor about an inch deep.
Yeah, that's true. Anything's possible. Anyway, that was the one thing that just kind of stuck out to me. But I'm trying to sit there. What?
Go ahead.
No, it's okay.
I've got a question for our, this is for you, Kirk, our resident FF scholar. And I was trying to, while Brian was giving us that wonderful synopsis, I was trying to find online. Obviously, because Reed mentions that the particle accelerator is an actual particle accelerator. So he's somehow shrunk it down or miniaturized it. Has Doom ever used PEM particles, or did he independently come up with some way of shrinking objects?
I don't recall that Doom ever used PEM particles, because that's a term or a development that occurs another decade or two later. However, Doom did create a shrinking array that he was going to use on them in FF number 10, and ultimately he blunders and gets exposed to it himself, so he shrinks and vanishes into nothing at the end of number
10. Doesn't he shrink them down in FF16? Into the microverse?
Yes. He's attacking them from the microverse, where this is all metaphysics, but, you know, he shrunk down to a size where it found another civilization that was at Subatomica, and then he was toying with and torturing the FF by shrinking them unexpectedly at various times. And ultimately, they enlist the use of Ant-Man, and they go after him. Yeah, I think it's 16, I think.
Yeah.
And then they come back and they almost immediately have another round with him in 17, The Many Traps of Dr. Doom. And that's the issue. That was my earliest issue that I ever had. So I was very familiar with that. But it was the second part of a two-part Dr. Doom story that really isn't part one and part two. It's just two sequential issues. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. I was just curious, because how he, if he actually produced all this stuff. And I think it says in the story, he produced this town for the puppet master. So he produced all of the miniature cars, everything, except and maybe he did make a miniature particle accelerator, but it would make more sense if he just shrank things down and put them out.
There's so much machinery involved in everything they had there, all the cars and other things that, I mean, he had to shrink stuff down instead of finding a way of manufacturing everything.
It'd been easier to shrink it down.
Yeah.
Well, the only other thing that I can think of about shrinking or growing, there was, I had an image in my mind. It's probably from Fantastic Four Annual number 3, the wedding of Reed and Sue, where Doom is wearing something over his index and middle finger. It's some sort of array that is allegedly growing molecules to the size of rocks and bombarding somebody. I don't recall who. Maybe it's Reed. Maybe it's Ben. I don't recall, but I have it's in my mind's eye that it was reprinted in a letters page at some point. That's the only other thing that I can think of, that he was shrinking or, in fact, growing molecules, which looked like rocks, to bombard one of the FF in a fight.
Hmm.
That's all I can tell you about that. That's the only other instance I can think of from the Silver Age, you know.
Yeah, I got to apologize for one thing to you guys and everybody else is that, and I'm checking to see if my omnibus. Okay, so I was going, when I was doing the synopsis, I was doing it from the copy of the Marvel Visionaries that I have on the Fantastic Four, and it is missing a page of the story.
Yeah, really? I found that out. I found that out when I was, it's when Ben first turns into the Thing.
Yeah, because, so Sue is having her dream where she calls Ben a coward, and then Ben starts a transformation. Well, it skipped that page and went right to Johnny attacking there. But no, actually, there's the page where Ben is transforming, and each frame is Ben. It starts off with the dinosaur hide, and then it becomes a little bit more coherent, and then it becomes more of the Rocky, and then, you know, the final trademarked Benjamin Grimm thing that everybody's aware, you know, happy with. I didn't realize that I'd miss that, but that's what I get for going through the one. I should have looked at my omnibus.
Well, I noticed that when I was reading it last night, so I pulled up the actual scan from the CD that has the watermark on it, and that's where I noticed it has the that missing page. And I'll say I think the original looks nicer than that scan of the Visionary, because it's cleaned up, but it's a little too bright. The colors are just a little too saturated on that, for my take. I think the scan actually looks a little better, even though it is a little dark in spots.
Well, this is the thing that I had said about the Champions books, that the copies of the original issues looked better than the omnibus or other reprints, where it just seemed to clean it up too much, make it too bright. So, yeah. And Byrne's art at this point, where he's inking himself, the pencil line isn't as thick as it becomes later.
Yeah. This is not quite the muddy look when he does himself later.
Well, what he had said is that when he started doing the Fantastic Four, he thought he was going to get Terry Austin to ink it. So he started inking it like Terry Austin. And so for the first number of issues, that's how he was doing it. And then as you get into, the late 40s and early 50s, his style changed a bit. But I always really liked this era of the Fantastic Four when he was drawing it. I liked it this way.
Whew. I did a little bit of research while you were talking. I found the image that I was talking about Doom growing the molecules. It's actually from FF issue 40, page 17, for those that don't want to go look for it. But that it's not important, so I won't even mention it. Carry on.
Is that, well, Kirk, is that when Kirby was using photo collage, actual photos he would cut out and put into his issues?
Yes, although that doesn't occur in this issue. Okay. This is drawn by Kirby, but it's inked by Vince Coletta. And so it's a very very different feel to it than our traditional FF looking. He only did it for like 6 issues or so. And this is sort of the midpoint of those issues. But no, yes, he was doing photo collage during this time period, but none appear in this particular issue. I believe there's one in 39, just the issue before.
He used to use it for like outer space or some kind of weird dimension,
right.
That right. kind of thing. He would.
Yeah. Let me ask, did any of you read Micronauts regularly?
Never.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the issue Micronauts 41? Because apparently you see Doom and the Puppet Master again in Littleville.
Yep.
Is that how Doom gets out?
No, I don't think it is. I had that at one time for that. Well, for this, not just for this reason, I was sort of collecting Micronauts. They have another adventure, as you say. The Micronauts go, they're looking for a way to get back to their own place, and they go to Doom's castle because they've heard about him having different machines that could perhaps get them back to their own microverse. And they find Littleville, of course, and then they encounter Puppet Master and Dr. Doom. They're still kind of trapped in there, sort of fighting one another. It wasn't that good, actually, which is why I don't still have it. But I'm sure I was looking at details online the other day because it was Micronauts 41. I was looking at some of the pages online the other day, and I was surprised when I got to the end. It's not clear that Doom escapes from that particular issue. He seems to be still stuck there at the end, and he's in another robot body, but he's also in his armor. And all the face mask gets melted. But no, I don't think he did escape from that particular issue. They were still stuck there, I think, at the end, and it's the Micronauts that escaped from them, if you like. They escaped from Littleville again.
Yeah, so, I'm trying, racking my brain to see if there's anything that mentions how Doom escaped. I think
I read something about there was a connection to FF246. Which is the one where they take his body that they got from the end of this story. They take his body back to the Latverian embassy. They've arranged for it all to be returned to the Latverian embassy, but Doom's already there in some way because he sets a trap for them.
Well, at this time he had been deposed as dictator, or whatever he called himself.
He wasn't in charge of Latveria still at the time. He lost out.
And apparently, in Littleville, he had made his own suit of armor.
Right, yeah. So that's what he was wearing. Yeah, that's what he was wearing in the Micronauts issue, yeah.
And then he swats Masters like a fly.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll probably have to cover that story one day later, sometime later.
Well,
It's not that good as... I was totally underwhelmed by the Micronauts issue.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the Micronauts, but reading the other Fantastic Four issues.
I collected the toys. I didn't collect the comic. I've got a few, but I collected the toys, which I love, but I didn't collect the comics.
Mm.
I only read the crossover with the X-Men, so I really didn't have much to do with that. But yeah, I might be interested in revisiting just for the Mike Gold art in some of them.
I'd pick them up when they were cheap.
Yeah, I got quite a few. Yeah, once I went and got all the back issues. But I didn't really like the stories where they were in like Earth 616, where they were meeting all the different Marvel characters.
They don't fit. They don't fit in.
Yeah, I preferred the stories where they were, you know, that took place in their own universe when they were fighting Baron Khazar and such like.
And those are all, what are those based on? Microman, I think it's what they started out in Japan. I think they were called Microman.
Mm.
And they brought them over here and called them Micronauts. Kind of what they did with the Transformers. They took those toys, gave them new names, brought them over here and sold them as the Transformers.
Right.
The Micronaut toys are top notch. I was a huge fan of those. I still have a lot of mine that I had as a kid.
I came by a ROM in the box this weekend.
Nice. Mm.
Couldn't pull the trigger. Anyway, I also came across I think it was a facsimile edition of ROM number one, but anyway, this actual story takes place right after Iron Man 149, 150. That's where Iron Man and Doom both wound up in King Arthur's court.
I always enjoyed that one. That's a fabulous story that I thought was the high point of the Iron Man series.
Mm. Yeah, I really enjoyed that too.
It's a good one.
Okay, so it says here that Doom lost the throne of Latveria in Fantastic Four 200 to Zorba Fortuna. Zorba. Mm. And he's since been trying to reclaim his throne since Fantastic Four Annual 15. I don't know which one that is. Mm. And then that's pretty much all the extra notes. Now, Kirk, there were 41 characters depicted on the cover.
Oh.
As what they say there. Obviously, originally there was going to be 42, but they removed Kirby.
So, is that listed like in the letters page at the end that they identify them all?
There is a page that has a guide.
There's a page in there.
Yeah.
In the original comic, it's the page before the double sided splash. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it was before the double-sided splash?
It's the page immediately before the double-page splash where Dr. Doom's towering over them.
It's at the bottom of it. I thought it was a full-page thing.
No, it's the second part of that, Yeah, they've got all the figures are numbered and it tells you who they were, who they are. Yeah.
One of the things I noticed on this read was when Doom says basically they're beneath him and he's going to leave, he turns his back on them. But that bottom panel, you see his cloak is green, but his hood is basically that kind of umber and black. But and that was in the Visionaries. The original book was also colored that way, but the omnibus is corrected.
Mm. So it looks a bit weird. with the funny colors. Yeah. Mm. But I'll tell you what, that double page splash, it always reminds me from when I first saw it of an episode of Land of the Giants.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was a Land of the Giants episode where they thought they'd found their way back home or something. They found this normal human size like village, but it turned out to be somebody who'd made a model village, and they were in one of the buildings, and I always remember somebody suddenly lifts the roof off and peers down at them just like that, like Doom's doing there.
That's something very much like a Twilight Zone episode where you have two people running around in a little village, you keep hearing a little girl giggle. And the final scene is she's in fact playing with them in either a doll's house or in a village set.
I've seen that one. Didn't they?
What it's called, but
yeah, it was a doll's house. That's right. Yeah.
Well, there's a There's two Twilight Zone. There's one where there's these four characters or five, I don't remember, are trying to get out of a room. And one's dressed like a toy soldier, one's dressed like a ballerina maybe. And it turns out they are toys in this box. And it's also, there's also another episode called The Little People, where these two astronauts land on a planet and one of them finds a little tiny group of people. And he watches them and somehow their evolution is sped up. So in the few days he's on this planet, he kind of loses it because they look at him as a god. And that's where, if you've seen that, there's a meme of a guy screaming out, "But I'm the god." And he wants them to worship him and he won't leave the planet. His partner says, "We got to go." So he's so enthralled with these little people worshiping him. And then when his partner leaves, and these other aliens land and they are giants and they find him. And then the little people see him as being fallible. So they tear down this statue of him that they built. So again, very Twilight Zone.
Yeah. I'm going to go a little Twilight Zone on you too. At this point, I'm trying to see what year this came out. And my computer is fighting me. But one thing I will say is the image on the next page after that double page spread of Doom standing over the town of Littleville is probably one of my favorite Fantastic Four comic images ever. Just him standing next to the town, and you see Reed and Sue and Ben and Alicia and Johnny and Franklin all jacked in. But
very Matrix-like.
Yeah, very Matrix-like. And this is, you know, good 18 years before The Matrix comes out. So
I was thinking it was very much like Alien when they're in their hibernation. Mm-hmm. And they're...
Now, I'm trying to see what year this is. But in the second volume of What If, issue 109, there was a what if story. What if the Thing was human again? And it basically shows Ben and Alicia walking on the sidewalk and a sign saying, "Welcome to Littleville."
Yeah.
And so it's basically the story of what if Ben and Alicia had stayed there. And they take that same image that we were just talking about. And that was the first page of the story. So you see everybody plugged into Littleville. And then Reed talking to Ben on the hilltop and Ben saying, you know, they're going to stay. So Reed, Sue, and Johnny, they go off, you know, and they let Alicia and Franklin stay with Ben and them. And they say, "We'll get you out as soon as we're done." And they never come back. And, you know, Ben keeps going and talking to, like, he does a confession with a priest, and it turns out the priest is doomed. You know, he just keeps seeing the Thing everywhere. So he goes to the college and turns on the particle accelerator, becomes the Thing again, and basically breaks out of Littleville to see, you know, of course, him and Alicia and Franklin's bodies jacked in, but to see the dead and mummified bodies of Reed, Sue, and Johnny.
Right.
It's a pretty messed up image.
Well, frequently those what if stories always end in a downer.
Yeah.
Because the message is, aren't you glad this didn't happen in our reality?
Well, it did end in a downer because still after everything that happened, Ben, Alicia, and Franklin still wind up stuck in Doom in a Doom simulation. This time it's the castle. But it basically has the same kind of picture, but it has them in the machine next to the castle and Doom standing there triumphant.
Yeah.
So, it's a pretty much everything you know is wrong three times over story.
Well, in this story, Reed is there to let Ben stay because he has that conversation. He says, I'm staying. You know, the world doesn't need the FF. They've got Avengers and Defenders and Spider-Man and all these other, we don't need us now. And Reed has a nice speech about, well, we're more than just heroes. You know, we have to we were given these powers. We have to do what we have to do.
Yeah.
But they established that all of the other robots are shut down. So if Ben and Alicia stay, they're not going to interact with the other robots because they're not doing anything. So they would be walking around almost like a ghost town.
I mean, Masters had reanimated them and forced them to attack Doom.
Yeah, but would he have done that if Alicia was? He might have, because he did this for his daughter. He wanted his daughter to be happy. Right. So he might have turned them all back on so they could continue this fake life that they've got until, I guess, their bodies naturally died or whatever would happen to them. But I will say that the scene where they all regain their powers and Alicia can see it's my thing's not numbered. He panics and doesn't want her because she can see. He doesn't want her to see him.
Right.
And it's a really sweet and tender three panels where she comes says, no, you know, you idiot. You think I love you because I can't see you and don't know what he goes. I always know what you know, I can feel your face and I know what you look like. You know, and she gives him a kiss. And I think that's a really sweet little moment they have together.
Yeah. No, it's quite touching.
Yeah.
Do you know what is the most human moment for Reed in the whole story, though?
He tells his wife to leave him alone?
No, it's when they're walking through the university towards the particle accelerator, and he comes across the still figure of his college student. And he's like, you know, I'd not expected to find Singh here. He was the closest to a friend I had on the staff. It's hard to accept now that he was only a robot. And you can see the look on his face. What's that, Kurt?
Still figure of who?
Singh. He was the colleague he had at the college.
Okay.
He has glasses and a mustache. He's got the same gray hair Reed's got.
Okay.
I mean, really, it's like talks about the marvel of you know, Doom's genius and whatever Masters put into it, that they were able to create this entire simulation. And so much so that, you know, Reed laments the loss of a friend, basically.
Well, I like the fact that, because when you first read it, you wonder, why would Doom put in an actual working accelerator? And he does address that, at least through Reed.
Yep.
Reed says it had to be real, or I would be able to tell that it was fake. Because otherwise, why would Doom take the risk or take the trouble of actually putting one of those down there? And the artwork on that, which is that corner bottom panel when you first see it, when he's come in, that's gorgeous. That is, I mean, it's a little, I think he's kind of paying homage to Kirby a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not as crazy as Kirby Tech, but it's very intricate and very detailed. It's nicely drawn.
Yeah. And now in my synopsis, I mentioned that Reed and Johnny had breakfast for lunch. Because it said that they've met at lunchtime the next day, but if you look on the plates that Ben gives them, it's obviously eggs and sausage and what looks like hash browns. And Reed's drinking coffee.
Yeah.
So that was an assumption on my part.
But he offers the Puppet Master a hamburger. When the Puppet Master comes in, it was like, I'll get you a hamburger. So
that's probably his regular.
Yep.
All right. Again, I'll say this. I love the artwork all through this. It's from that era that just is amazing. And I understand why he went away from it, but I kind of lament that. Plenty of detail. And just, oh, amazing.
Do you think on the when Reed stabs himself, which I thought was, why don't you just draw some blood? But man, he just jams that into his arm. That's a little Terminator-like. That was a little Terminator 2, I thought, when Arnold takes...
I had no idea where this was going. when he did that. It was like, I didn't know what was up.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, what they kind of glossed over that a little bit, because if they were synthoclones, then what would have come out would have been blood and not some kind of lubricant or whatever would be pumping through a robot's systems. You know,
they refer to them as robots throughout the issue.
So not them. They refer to them as synthoclones.
So the rest of everybody else are robots. Okay.
Sing and all them were robots. I don't know if Doom was a robot or if he was a synthoclone, but based on how it went, I think Doom's was a robot. Yeah, Doom was a robot, that's for sure. So it was only the Fantastic Four, Alicia, and Franklin that were synthoclones. Everything else was a robot.
Okay.
And you talk about the red fluid coming out. I have an amusing side story about Disney. It's a shame that that Scott's not here because he may have heard this one. But when they started Disneyland, there was a feature on Main Street called the Hall of the Presidents, where the presidents were on stage and they were animatronic. You know, they would basically stand or turn or nod or, you know, just had some human movement to them. But when they started this and they were building them, there was at least one figure of Lincoln who stands out of his chair and delivers a very impassioned speech to the audience. I don't recall what the speech was, but as the story goes, he was powered by hydraulics. And that's how he was able to stand and move and gesture, that it was all pre-programmed and timed, except the hydraulic fluid hose sprung a leak. And as a result, the red fluid that was inside bled out on one particular show and soaked his white, you know, his white dress shirt. Anyways, the point was that he collapsed or slowly sat down sadly in his chair as he was bleeding out, and it freaked out the audience something terrible. And as a result, the powers that be at Disneyland declared, immediately, we are replacing all the red hydraulic fluid with clear hydraulic fluid from now on.
Makes sense.
I'm told that's a true story. I'd like to check that out. Maybe Scott, if he's listening, could confirm that. But as a result, they never had that incident before or since.
Well, they were just reenacting the John Wilkes Booth shot him.
Not quite that, but yeah, that was the inference. Everybody was pretty shocked in that audience. Like, what is going on? So,
well, let me ask you this. Now, Kirk, you said you read it when it first came out.
Yes.
And Nigel, did you?
Yes, I got it as it came out. Yeah.
I did not. I didn't read it until 87, summer of 87. Mm. And Tim?
I didn't read it when it first came out. It was when I was collecting back issues, so I don't know. Sometime in the mid-80s, I would probably about the same time.
When any of you read it the first time and you saw Victor Vaughn, did you know that that was Dr. Doom's identity in the story?
Well, it's a pretty heavy-handed hint name.
Yeah.
And is he not drawn with some facial features where he's particularly nasty to read and maybe arched eyebrows.
He's got arched eyebrows.
I was going to say, it's more a case of what he looked like that you think, this guy, you know, might be Doom. Yeah, because he's not very nice. Yeah.
I don't think I went there that it was Doom, but clearly he was not the villain of the piece, but he was certainly not a nice guy. And I got that.
There's one panel where his face is drawn in particular, where he first comes in behind Reed when he's looking at that machine.
Accelerator.
Yeah, and he says, you know, you're not gonna do anything with that, Richards. And then he's there behind over his shoulder, and the way they've drawn his face there, it's it's like you can see it's an older version of, you know, when they did the Doom origin story in the Fantastic Four annual number 2, I think it was.
Yeah.
You can see that it's almost like this is the grown-up boy's face.
Yeah.
That you saw from that origin story. And his eyebrows are like raised up because he's
a little devilish looking like that. Like
his
arched eyebrows. And then later
in Fantastic Four 278, when they show, you know, Doom's full origin, you can tell that that's a younger version of this guy.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
And that ring is very prominent as he grabs his lapels. That ring is on his
true.
Well, it's with the same place you wear a wedding ring, which is interesting.
Mm. But
Ray is wearing that waistcoat that Byrne loves to draw on people in suits.
when I first read this, I wasn't that impressed with the story, actually. I mean, I've grown to appreciate it over time, but yeah, because, you know, bearing in mind it was like the 20th anniversary issue and it was a double or triple sized issue, and I don't know, I guess I expected something different, and so I was a bit disappointed with the storyline.
Anniversary stories in annuals always have like a gigantic cavalcade of guest characters and whatnot, and you see all these characters on the front cover, make you think it's going to be something like
that.
You know? Yeah. I would have been happier if this had been printed in an annual. And I don't know that they were doing annuals at that time. But
yeah, because the next issue after this was annual 16, I think.
I mean, coming up later on, we get to 17, as I recall. That's the black frame one with the skulls and the milk. That is just a superb story. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, this felt like it should have been off to the side in an annual. Mm-hmm. That's just my feeling. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I can wish and hope that it was that way in my headcanon, it's that way, but, you know, it doesn't make any difference.
And then the way he told the story, which, like, from the very start, well, after the first three pages, which is Johnny's dream, and then it's like, you know, they're already living in Littleville and they're different, you know, they've already been altered from being the Fantastic Four. And I'm like, so what's happened then? You know, how did they get here?
Right.
I didn't always like that sort of story that started what I call halfway through. He did the same, or I don't know whether it was his idea or Claremont's, but they did the same with the X-Men story, didn't they? With Magneto. They started it
exactly
like from that sort of funfair carnival thing, and they've already been captured and they're already acting out of character, and you're like, have I missed an issue?
Right. But it really draws you in.
But it works.
What's going on? Terry Austin said that he loved those types of stories. He loved to work on them. Mm-hmm. That was his favorite type of story. And obviously he was referring to the X-Men story. Mm-hmm.
But this is a similar thing. Yeah.
It would be, if it was a TV show, it'd be Act One. And then after the commercial break, there'd be a teaser of like, wait a minute, this is not what you think. Commercial break, come back, and then it's realized that you would come back and realize, oh, they're not really in the circus, or they're not really shrunk, whatever. Then they would reveal the rest, you know. But I had a question on Doom and his ring, the way he transfers back and forth. This is prior to it being revealed that he knows how to do the mind swap that he does in FF 260 when he's about to be killed by the Surfer and Pirates, right?
Not quite.
Ovoids.
Let me think. Where is this? I believe it's FF number 10 that's where he learns from the ovoids this technique of how to switch bodies, because that's a major plot point in that story. So it's been established years before that that okay. Doom has this ability or had it at one time. And he's never used it until we get to the modern day story you're talking about.
Mm. Was that when he gets rescued when he at the end of the Baxter Building in Space story and he grabs the passing asteroid and he disappears? Are they the ones that rescue him? Is that how he survives that?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
I know they rescue, he's floating in space following some kind of, or is it the one where he kind of caught them in this like room which got
You're thinking of 24.
Drifted into space, yeah. And then the room was slowly disappearing and
That resolution to that being trapped in outer space occurs that's where he meets Kang and the whole paradox is introduced. That's where that comes from. At the end of 24, it leads to that. The Ovoid is between issues 6 and his return at 10. And he tells the tale to probably to Reed and to Stan and Jack.
That's right.
This is how I escaped. Yeah. Back because the Ovoids rescued me, and you will call the FF and summon Reed to your weekly or monthly story conference, and then he grabs Reed and in issue 10 trades bodies with Reed.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
which really upset me because when we get to Daredevil numbers 37 and 38. And he switches bodies with Daredevil.
Does it again?
He needs a machine instead of this ability that he's already learned. So that's
one writer not talking to another writer.
Right. If somebody didn't know the background, it could have been excused by a line saying, yeah, I had the ability to do it once, but now I need a machine to amplify it or something. But never mind. I'm on a rant.
But then he obviously got his ability to do it without the machine again because he did it in 260.
Yeah, but I think in this thing, he's talking about transferring his mind back and forth between his own body and a robot.
A robot,
which is completely different from transferring with another person.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep. I love the revenge, though. The revenge from Master's point of view, that was a great way to end the story, but it just seemed like Doom got too lucky to survive. But then it's comic book, so you have to accept that.
Mm.
Wasn't there a movie by the name of Terror in a Tiny Town?
It
was an all little people.
Yeah, or the tiny town.
And he just borrowed the title, right?
Because it's been used a lot in a number of different forms of literature and media.
I've never seen the movie, but I remember, again, God, we're talking 40 years ago or so, reading this in a letters page where somebody was discussing this issue, and I still remember some of the comment. It's amazing.
And when I was reading this story, I was reading it last night, and I either saw it's either written in the story or it's in dialogue, and it says it's Littleville, and my brain saw that, and because he spells it a little differently, I read it as Lidsville, that Sid and Marty Krofft TV show about the talking heads.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kept wanting to say Littlesville.
Yeah.
I had to fight that one really hard. But that was fun. Well, I don't got anything else except that I really, really enjoyed it. I was glad to do this one. Been wanting to do it for quite a while. I still think that his Fantastic Four run was probably one of the greatest runs in comic book history. And
certainly one of the strongest. I mean, if if you hear this a lot, like, I want to read FF, where do I start? Or I want to read John Byrne, where do I start? I mean, with Byrne, it was obviously, you read the X-Men, and then you read, but you know, a lot of that's not his writing. You read this. You read this, his whole run on the FF, which is.
Yeah, what is it? 232 through what? 290?
293 or 4.
And if you don't count the earlier ones he did.
The She-Hulk on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was Terror of
tiny town.
Okay.
1938.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was a creepy, creepy movie. Wow.
Yeah, that's what I always heard.
I do agree with you, Kirk, that this feels like an annual story, not a sequential story. It feels like kind of almost like a little standalone story.
Well, are we finished?
Do we do that still or not? Or
what?
Do we grade these books? Like, what? Did we stop?
We do that. We only did that when we were dealing with like Back to Ben's guys, but we haven't been grading anything.
If you want to read it,
you can grade it.
What?
You can grade it if you want to.
I'm A's across the board. Art, writing, cover, all A's. I mean, really, the cover's an A+. But, you know, beyond that, it's all A's. It's an A book. I just enjoyed it so much. I mean, I've always enjoyed this one, even from when I first read it to today. I like to give it a look at it every couple of years. And so, like I said, I'm glad to come back and do this.
I think Nigel and I are pretty similar in terms of our reactions to it. Maybe it was a function of the time or our age, but it didn't quite fire on all cylinders for me, and that's why I haven't gone back to revisit it. I won't. I know it's highly regarded, and I won't speak against it, but it doesn't have quite as much charm as other people seem to. You know, give it. So, B+, A-.
I'm going to say, I would still say it's an A book. Yeah, yeah. But it's not my favorite Fantastic Four story by Byrne. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd agree. I think that I would, artwork, yes, I'd give it an A. The story, A-, B+, only because the story is a little... Nothing to take away from it, but the story is a little derivative because it's kind of the thing you've seen done before, where somebody wakes up, they think it's one thing, and it's revealed that it's something else.
That actually was a topic of discussion on Byrne's site, and there's actually a twist in it, and I need to find that because...
Well, he did it recently, not recently, but he did it later on in Next Men.
Yeah.
Basically... In the first issue, wasn't it, where they wake up?
Yeah, they wake up from the Matrix 10 years before the Matrix was made.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you've seen this in Star Trek, where the episode would start, and our characters in some weird situation where they're acting differently, and then it turns out that they're in some kind of computer simulation, or their brain's been transplanted, something like that. So that's when I say derivative, I mean it's not
right.
It's not a pejorative, but it's just, we've seen it before. Typical sci-fi.
Yes. Riker, in particular, trying to be tricked by the Romulans, and the other characters on the bridge are just slightly out of character. Picard, Data.
What episode is that one? That's.
I don't know the name, but I just recently saw that scene on Facebook. Somebody had shared about 2-3 minutes of it, and I went, oh yeah, that's right.
That's there's a similar one with the same Riker where he wakes up, he's in a mental institution, and they're telling him that he's imagining that he's in Starfleet and all that. Yes. And it turns out that later it is. His head keeps bleeding, and it turns out he has been there's another one called Conundrum where they wake up and Riker's not first officer, some other guy is.
And, yep, and they don't have their memory of what they did.
Yep.
Now, the question was raised of a Byrne, was this the first superhero story ever where the heroes seem to wake up? Is it their superhuman lives were all some strange dream? And then they figure out they've been kidnapped and brainwashed. I remember seeing a lot of stories like this in the 80s and 90s, and you recycled the motif yourself in Next Men. But was there one before this that you know of? And he says, no, but it may have been the first one that didn't assume the readers could be fooled by the revelation. Anybody know what that really means?
No.
Maybe that he maybe he didn't try to trick you that he left clues. Maybe he expected you to figure it out and not to be 100% shocked when you see the doom looming over the model. You know, because he does, you know, there is something when you first see Vaughn, when he's thinking to himself, he says the plan's working or something like that. So it tells you that there's something going on. It's not a normal world. Mm. So maybe that's what he's trying to, you know, he wasn't trying to fool that's everybody.
A comic books, we can hear their thoughts depending on the writer. And that's something unique to comic books where you can read their inner thoughts and see where people have been misled or they're making the incorrect assumption. The only other place that I think I've seen something like that would have been a TV show where you hear the character's voiceover that they're thinking because there's nobody to talk to. I can't remember what episode it would be, probably a Twilight Zone, but you can hear their thoughts. That's the only thing that I can think of that's similar.
Mm.
So we've rated this. Is there any other business? We've been at this almost 90 minutes. Anything else we need to cover?
No, I think you're good to take us out.
Okay. Well, as we usually say, we want to hear from you, lovely listener, and there are a number of ways that you can do that. The quickest and easiest is probably posting to our Facebook page, Third Degree Burn. You can also write us at gottagetburned.gmail.com, right? Have I got that right?
Gmail.com. Yeah, you got it.
And then there was formerly Apple Tunes. I never use that one. So you tell me, Brian, what's the
iTunes formerly? I mean, Apple Podcast formerly iTunes.
Okay, there we go. And
I want to work with Tim on getting our library there built back up. If there's a way, if we can do it. Because right now there's only like 4 or 5 episodes up there because of how things got mixed up with a lot of different podcasters.
Yeah,
not just us.
It's not just us.
That's how you can reach us. We want to hear from you. We want to know, do you agree with our assessment of this issue, or are we all wet? Or is it the best thing that Burns ever done? We want to hear your opinion, and if you agree or disagree, we'd like to be able to share that. And who knows? Maybe we'll read your letter on the air. I guess for Third Degree Burn, I'll introduce the panel so we can say goodnight. We'll go around the alphabetically around the group here. I'm Kirk Greenfield, Tim Elliott.
Good night.
Brian.
Good night, Gracie.
And Nigel.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's tutufreaks.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Take care.